Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, May 14th, 2010, I am delighted to welcome Ryan Tate, editor of the ever-popular Valley Wag. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
So good. I'm so happy to talk to you on many levels.
Yeah, I know. It's only been about 10 years since we last
So Ryan and I know each other. Yes, good to hear yours as well, even though mine still sounds like I'm recovering from laryngitis. But yeah, our paths have crossed many times, and who knew that you would end up the editor of Valley Wag?
Seriously, so, my God. What is the world coming to?
And if people search your name in Valley Wag, they'll probably find the post that I think your editor at the time posted about you actually being the new Valley Wag, and at the cafe photo with the person moving in the background.
Yeah.
And talking about how you had been a night editor, and you had done such a great job because you had very scoopy pieces.
Oh, I'm glad you... So, I'm glad someone actually read the stuff that went up in the middle of the night.
Oh, Ryan, come on, it's you. I always read your stuff. Come on.
That's sweet.
So,
that is very sweet. Well,
so I want to talk about first, obviously it was, you know, Valley Wag has been very popular even before Gawker owned it. And
right. It used to be what I read.
Yeah.
I mean, I read Gawker, but I started first reading Valley Wag.
Yeah, so I think it would be interesting for people to have a sense of who you replaced and kind of how Gawker came into the picture and then where you fit in.
Sure, yeah, I'm happy to talk about that because it is a little, I think it did get a little confusing. So Gawker Media always owned Valley Wag, but it was a distinct site from when Nick Denton started it, I think, I want to say 2006 or so, maybe it was 05, maybe even earlier than that, but yeah, it was a standalone site just covering Silicon Valley. I think Nick Denton was the first. Nick Denton, Nick Douglas, and Nick Carlson were sort of some of the first sort of editors. I forget what order they came in, but and then Owen Thomas was. Yeah, this was all a long time ago, and then Owen Thomas was the guy who came in right before I did. Although he was there for a good couple of years, and really sort of, I think really crystallized kind of the voice of Valley Wag as kind of an antidote to what you might call, I guess as an antidote to some of the other coverage in Silicon Valley, sort of trying to balance maybe the all too cheery and all too corporate coverage that you can find out there with some of the, with something a little bit more mean, but also just a little bit more honest. And so what happened was Owen actually did a great job, and the traffic grew, but it wasn't enough. It was never enough, I think, from the beginning to be. And you know, Nick talked about this publicly, but I don't think it was ever enough financially for the site to be a profitable part of Gawker Media. So Nick Denton folded Valley Wag into Gawker.com proper. So it became like a channel of Gawker. In other words, all this stuff from Valley Wag, everything that runs in Valley Wag runs in Gawker, runs on the front page of Gawker and on the front page of Valley Wag at the same time. But if you just want to see the Valley Wag stuff and you don't care about celebrity news and you don't care about some of the other stuff Gawker covers, like sort of inside New York media stuff, then you can just go to valleywag.com and still get, you know, kind of your pure hit of sort of Silicon Valley tech gossip. And you're not going to see as much content as when it was Owen overseeing two or three other people, but we are trying to make it, you know, kind of aim for, keep the really high impact stories that he had done and do some more of those. You'll see less of sort of the smaller characters in the Valley, which I kind of regret sometimes that we can't cover more of the smaller stuff, but I think some of those smaller characters who might have felt picked on by Valley Wag before probably appreciate the fact that we don't do those things, you know, things about individual journalists or individual, you know, sort of smaller entrepreneurs, you know, unless they're posing nude, like the CEO of Mint, unless they're posing nude for pictures and drawings, and we're probably not were probably not as interested in some of the smaller minutia stuff. So I don't know if that's too long of an explanation, but that's basically what happened. Gawker was independent, started independent as part of sort of a standalone site within Gawker Media, and then got folded into Gawker.com proper. Now it's kind of a channel of Gawker.com. It's basically just part of the main Gawker.com feed, but you can splice it off and read it separately if you want.
And we should tell the audience that, you know, if you don't know already, there was already we've interviewed Nick Douglas separately,
right?
And he had an interesting perspective on his time there because he's very, very young when he had the role, and so you know, obviously, you know, I think one of the things that's also interesting to note about, so you can go back and listen to his take on his career in that previous podcast, but I think one of the interesting things to note is that so many that are in the Silicon Valley were so disappointed, and it was kind of, I dare say, controversial that ValleyWag was folded into the larger Gawker Media, I think from the perspective of being relied on by a lot of people to potentially cover some of the things that you talked about, but also the worry that it would take over and become a celebritization, if you will, of the characters that are already celebrated in media. So people like Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, those that would already be written about elsewhere. Do you feel like you've been able to kind of balance that a bit and allay concern?
I hope so. I mean, there's definitely been a lot of Steve Jobs, and there's definitely been a lot of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, a lot of Eric Schmidt. At the same time, I feel like those sort of characters have become so much more important to the culture as a whole than they were even 5 years ago. The influence of Apple has gone from sort of something that, like, kind of a fairly small clique of, like, fanboys obsessed over to something that basically everyone in global media has to pay attention to because their customer base has grown so much and there are so many people who use those products and they have such an influence on culture. And the same could be said for Facebook and Google. I mean, their influence has just grown so much in the last few years. So it's sort of incumbent upon us to really, you know, cover them pretty heavily. But I do, you know, I mean, we have plenty of posts on, you know, topics that are not Facebook, that are not Google, that are not Apple. There are the smaller stories. You know, we still do like the Jason Calacanis versus Mike Arrington when we can get a little bit of reporting done on it. On that. We've done stuff on some of the smaller, you know, again, the Mint.com guy, some of the smaller, you know, like the Orkut at Google is kind of like a low-level executive that most of America doesn't care about. But when he had a big party, you know, with like kind of go-go boys, half-naked go-go boys at his glamorous loft south of Market, we were sure to do a post about that. And when Marissa Meyer got married, you know, we still had like three or four posts on that. So I feel like we're still getting into some of the non-celebrity people. I'm definitely, it's not going to be as much. We're not going to be doing that as often simply because it's just me. And so we kind of have to focus on some of the bigger stories. But I feel like we're still doing it a little bit. I feel like it's still there. I mean, there's still like plenty of stories that come into my mind. It's just on a day-to-day basis, you probably won't see as much of that. It's a little fewer and farther between. But on the other hand, when we do hit on it, we try to hit on it in a big way that will make like the rest of the country care instead of just like, you know, oh, here's this like little tidbit of gossip without sort of, we try to really like let's get pictures of it and let's like really explain why it matters. And you know, let's like take something that might have been split across six or seven posts in the old days and like put it into one monster, like, you know, here's the definitive post on Orkut or here's the definitive like Marissa Meyer wedding post. So I don't know if that answers the question, but
so,
you know, I mean, it's never going to be, like, you're right, it was a controversial move, and as someone who always read ValleyWag, I always wanted to read it as a standalone site, and I, you know, as someone who loved Paul and who worked with Owen at, I mean, Owen and I go back, like, we were coworkers at Business 2.0, and I always admired his writing, and, you know, him and Jackson and Jordan Gulson and all those writers, Nick Douglas and Nick Carlson and all those guys. I would have loved to keep reading it as a standalone site. So it'll never be quite the same as when it was a standalone site in terms of just the volume of stuff, but hopefully what we're really shooting for is, like, you know, the quality and having, if we can't have the quantity of stuff, at least have a higher quality. Not necessarily even a higher quality, but at least just like kind of the best of stuff.
So kind of ValleyWag as journalism with a capital J. A little less.
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. We don't do, We don't. We're still a gossip. I mean, we're still, you know, we still call ourselves, I think Silicon Valley's gossip sheet or something like that is the official tagline. So we're, you know, we're still gossipy. We still probably do less reporting than a mainstream newspaper would. But absolutely. I mean, we, on certain stories, we were making a lot of phone calls. You know, when we're doing something on Eric Schmidt, and his, you know, and the rumors about his private life, we're on a story like that, we're typically making a good number of phone calls and having long conversations with people. So yeah, I mean, some of those stories I would call big J journalism, and other ones I would call, you know, shorter blog posts. That, you know, when, if you're doing a shorter post, you know, we're not always going to make a ton of calls. But yeah, we are trying to do a lot more of the big J journalism. And Owen did, you know, I mean, Owen did a lot of that too. But we're trying to make it a higher proportion of what we do because we're going to be doing less. I mean, we have been doing, in terms of quantity, less than the old Valleywag did.
So let's talk about your background because I think it definitely influences your perspective about journalism with a capital J. So people know more about who you are. You obviously sound young. You are young. So married and all of that, you know.
Married, early 30s. I have a 3 in my in my age.
So
I'm not sure if you do, but I do.
You sound very young, and I was older than you at the time, so you know that I'm in the same club as you.
Okay.
I'm sure we're probably
pretty similar.
But yeah, so I think that it would be interesting. You mentioned knowing some of the people that you have worked with in a previous life. Talk us through your career as it relates to Valleywag or doesn't, you know?
Yeah, and maybe I can bring you into this a little bit too, just because, well, I'll just mention
this. Why not?
So we knew each other back when you were at a startup called React TV. Can I mention that? It was like Zatso is what they eventually rebranded, interactive television, and I just bring that up because those were kind of the glory.com days in San
the
Francisco.
The 1998,
99.
Yeah,
and that was a really interesting, actually, startup. Like, the one you worked for was trying to do kind of truly interactive newscasts before those newscasts existed. And it's not even really, they don't even really fully exist yet, but it was the kind of stuff we're seeing a lot more of.
I was just going to say, they still don't exist. I think it's
but we have, at least we have the online video, which was so rare back then. We have some of the YouTube stuff. But,
so,
I mean, so, yeah. I don't know if you...
So we met during the heyday, and you were
during
working
the heyday.
Where were you working? Were you working at Red Herring at one point?
So that was like Vinny, our mutual friend, my ex-girlfriend who we knew each other through, but I was at Upside, which was another one of the dot-com magazines. And actually, Upside was something, it was a magazine I had read since I was in college at Berkeley. I used to read Dave Weiner's awesome website, scripting.com, which was kind of like one of the very first blogs. I had read his column in Wired magazine, and then I read his thing, and he moved off of Wired to his own server and did his blog, and he used to always link to this thing called Upside and the Daily Tish, and, you know, I was always reading these, like, kind of cheeky business tech articles that were kind of, you know, a lot of them were, it was stuff no one else was writing about at the time, because this was kind of like the very beginning of the mid-90s, and it was, you know, startups and venture capital, and at the time, there wasn't, like, a lot of coverage of that. It was before Red Herring, it was before... but way before TechCrunch. It was kind of the TechCrunch of its era, though. And so when I got out of college, Upside had a lot of competition, but it was kind of like one of the places I really wanted to go. And so I kind of feel like Upside in a lot of ways is one of the spiritual ancestors of Valleywag, because they were kind of famous from the beginning for trying to sort of be the Rolling Stone of tech and can turn these CEOs who are so boring, right? Like Larry Ellison's interesting, right? But like by the standards of Hollywood, like he's still kind of just a business executive. I mean, he's a billionaire, yes, and he was a playboy, but he's still just kind of. But like Upside was one of the first to really like let's draw cartoons of them and make them into these like characters and.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's talk a little bit about the personal life and a little bit about the controversies. So, to give you the concrete answer, yeah, from that was my first job out of college was writing for Upside's website, Upside Today, covering Napster and digital media from 2000 to, it was really only about, was it 2 years, a year and a half? I mean, I started writing for them in college. So I think it was about 2 years. And then, you know, it lasted for a while after the bubble burst and then kind of melted down, and I jumped over to Business 2.0, which is where I met Owen, Business 2.0 magazine. But you know, I feel like Upside is one of those things that's kind of gotten lost to the tides, but I really had a soft spot for that magazine, and you know, I actually had dinner with Dave Bunnell not too long ago, the former CEO and one of the earliest investors in Upside, and you know, he's still kind of launching magazines and launching new ideas, but it was really good to catch up with him on those old days of Upside, and so yeah, that was the first thing, and then Business 2.0, and then the whole thing ended, and I stopped covering tech for about 6 or 7 years. you know, Business 2.0 eventually was folding, and I mean, I wasn't there till the bitter end, but I was there for, you know, probably another year over there, and then ended up covering restaurants and hotels and just general business stuff for, gosh, like 6 or 7 years, and then came back to tech via Gawker.
Wow.
So
it's
yeah,
it's been a while.
I know your story is similar because you ended up back in sort of like, you know, conventional TV, right? And
well, I was recruited. Well, from Zaps, I was recruited to ABC Owned Stations Group and worked to get their video online. So they were still part of City Search. So my job was to migrate. City Search obviously radically changed its business model from partnering with local stations to being what it is really today, which is kind of an early Yelp, I guess, with less value on the UGC that would come out of it, right? And
yeah.
Anticipating that movement.
But it definitely predated Yelp.
Yep. So moving, you know, being able to separate those two, and then helping the group figure out how to, you know, take advantage of its various properties, making sure there was agreement and alignment. So there's a lot of business work and relationship management to be done, but ultimately it was getting to do things like help broker a deal for the Owned Stations Group with Broadcast.com when Mark Cuban still owned it right before the acquisition, because that all happened while I was still at ABC.
Okay.
And I stayed at ABC until I went back to school, went back to Columbia Journalism School, simply because, you know, I had done so much early digital media work, and I'd done everything from biz dev to product to creative to, you know, marketing, budgeting, everything, that, you know, ABC was very nice and obliged, and they sent me different places to try to see if, you know, maybe it would be good to move to L.A., would I want to move to New York, and I went, you know, they sent me those places to meet with people to see if there would be an interesting opportunity. I feel like I hit kind of the digital ceiling. There just wasn't really much left to conquer, so
right.
I went back to my roots of journalism with a capital J and went to Columbia and got my degree. That was seven years into my career, but then coming out, I kind of had to rebuild. So I was, you know, a senior editor and all of that very, very early. I mean, I was an executive producer of regular television and on air right out of college in local television news, as you well know. You knew all this when you met me. But the years that have followed,
time.
You know, since we talked is the – you know, all the work I did at ABC, the J School stuff, and then, you know, all of the pieces that have led to what is now my web strategy consultancy and, you know, some teaching I do for Media Bistro and you know, of course, my podcast, which is a big love
which
of mine,
great.
And I feel like harkens back to the roots of why I wanted to be a journalist in the first place, to give people access, hopefully to give broader access and crowdsource questions for folks like you.
And you've had great guests. I mean, I was, you know, felt like very honored to be in the company of, like, you know, of all your guests. You know, I mean, some of the names that popped out were like Guy Kawasaki and Kara and Nick, but, you know, there was like all, you know, I mean, I think Seth Godin was in there too. I mean, there was a lot of names.
Seth was there. Yeah, we had Seth on the Friday before his book came out the following Tuesday, and Kara was so nice. She actually wrote a post on, you know, podcasts when they're done well or something she really likes, and she felt like our podcast was a really good one. So usually
awesome.
I don't go into this much personal detail. But
no, I understand. I just wanted to ask
personally.
What I thought. I always listen to people on your podcast, and they talk a lot, and I'm always interested, but then I'm like, well, am I going to sound like – like, are people going to be telling me to shut up and stop talking? So I really wanted to – I was personally curious, so I thought, well, let's – like, I wanted to ask you about – I don't know, sort of, because I think it was sort of like your background, because I just think it's really interesting, because I think it's somewhat parallel to mine. I think it's really kind of shows you know, I think we both went through this where things kind of go in these cycles, particularly with tech, because tech has all of, you know, I mean, these boom bust things go back, you know, back to the 70s and the 80s, and there's always these like kind of fallow periods in between, which is like if you think about it, where all of the really interesting things happen, because the technologies that get developed need time to ferment. Developing them is one thing, but actually socially integrating them and developing them and actually making them work on a societal level takes so much longer. And there's these kind of these long periods of kind of experimentation and non-profitability and change are just so key. What you said about your background, I thought, like, really illustrated that as well. And I think my career has been sort of like that, too.
Yeah, where you kind of have to just, you know, look at, like, the most creative option. And you know, like, after I left J school, I gave myself a trip to Europe. So I spent a lot of time in Europe, and then I ended up marrying a Brit whose family they've lived in, you know, outside of London. Now they live in the north. His dad's in Normandy and his France, and his my two nephews and sister and brother-in-law live in Sydney Harbour. And actually, just the interesting part there is they had lived in Sydney because my brother-in-law used to be the CFO of Dell's Asia Pacific region. So, you know, that's an interesting, you know, connection to the international. And I do a lot of work with companies that have pieces all over the place. But one thing that I think is really interesting is when I get into my work and I've got stuff going on all over the place, and I look, you know, and I want to know, you know, kind of what's happening with the influencers, and I go to ValleyWag, you know, sometimes I get bored of seeing the same names, and I feel like it infiltrates international. Mm. And I'll give you an example. So at Le Web, Robert Scoble, who I think is a great guy, but never makes time for my show, so I have to be better about that.
little dig.
Big dig to Mike Arrington, not just because of the mood swings, but because I actually genuinely think he's rude, and he's not a journalist with a capital J, and doesn't respect what that is. So I think it's fine to say.
He's been really. I mean, in the few contacts I've had, he's been a really good guy to me. But you know. I've heard. I mean, his reputation does, and we've written about this. I don't feel like I'm speaking out of school, but his reputation does precede him on that to a certain extent.
Yeah,
he knows that and kind of embraces it in a way. So it's
he does.
But if I was in your shoes on your end of it, I might be feeling the exact same way. So
well, here's
interesting
the thing.
Guy
so
because of that.
There's you know, that makes him an interesting character. And if he wanted to be interviewed, sure, I would. Am I going to pursue him? Probably not, just because he's just too contrarian. I mean, one day he might say yes enthusiastically, and the next day, and this has happened at an event, the next day it's like he acts like he doesn't even know who I am. So,
right.
You know, that's really not very interesting, because this program is about whether or not I know the person. It's about developing a conversation. If you don't want to have that conversation, it's not meant to be controversial. And he has an editor from the UK. I think it's not obviously Ben Parr's at Mashable, but I think his last name's Parr. Maybe you know who he is.
Carr. Maybe Paul Carr?
Paul Carr had a panel at Le Web, as a good example of the Silicon Valley taking something that's very international and doing something with it that maybe as a skeptical American I don't really like. So having traveled a lot, there's the sort of typical American scenario, and my husband says there's sort of the typical UK scenario. And what Paul Carr did is he basically took a group of very successful business people and said, you know, the panel was supposed to be about why start businesses in Europe and versus the United States or anywhere else, Cyprus, you know, really looking at Europe and the EU versus the States and the rest of the world. And what could have been a really interesting discussion turned into Paul Carr asking more than 15 times, why not just F off on a plane to the Silicon Valley and get your money? Why did you F off to the Silicon Valley? So he was being contrarian to the point where he was not only belittling the guest, he wasn't getting an answer that anyone was engaged with because people started leaving the room. And three, it was just not educational. Because, for example, if someone's doing something creative that really maps to TED, they should be in the UK actually leveraging that. And it was sort of like he combined the UK and the US And people like Ian Dodsworth, who I happen to be sitting near, who from TweetDeck, who did F off to the Silicon Valley to get money, but develops out of the UK and actually has his community manager. He lives in Provence in France, but is English by heritage. He and I are just kind of laughing at it, but at the same time, when I look back at it, it really made me angry because I felt like we basically this sort of Silicon Valley bubble that Ian called it that before I did, so I can't claim to have said it, had really taken over. You had Robert Scoble leading many panels the first day. You had Mike Arrington doing two interviews. And actually, I walked out during one when he was interviewing Marissa Mayer. He said, let me butter you up a little bit or something to this effect. I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
You know, you were listed as one of Glamour Magazine's 10 most beautiful in tech or some crap like that. And it wasn't what he said or that he thought that was actually an appropriate way to start an interview with her. And I would say that it's not appropriate for a number of reasons. One, just because you're not going to engage half the audience, which was female, in much of a dialogue there, because I hope that her end goal is not to be in Glamour Magazine with her work at YouTube, especially if she's working all the time, which, according to her quotes, would indicate that she was working at her wedding. But, you know, I just thought, you know, her response, which was, oh, thank you, you know, was very much the sort of, you know, I've been a geek my whole life. I may have had a really awkward coming out period, and now I'm kind of pretty, and I work in tech. And, you know, compared to Hollywood starlets, I'm not gorgeous, but, yeah, I made Glamour Magazine, and wow. And that's just sort of turned my tummy, I guess, in a bit. And what I felt like was we weren't getting to the basis of what LaWeb is usually about, which is this great connection between businesses and startups. And I actually talked to a couple of people that had come in from the coastal area of France where it was beautiful and sunny and it had been rainy that entire time in Paris, and they complained to me the entire time about being there in rainy Paris when they were forced to listen to so much banter that came from this U.S. perspective. And I think again, Ian Dodsworth from TweetDeck was the one that called it the bubble, and Richard, his community manager, agreed and was captured in some of my podcasting from there. But all of this to say, in terms of a few things, one being kind of the on-the-record gossip with a journalism infusion of ValleyWag, how much do you feel like people are overvaluing their own worth when it comes to what Gawker does in a larger aspect? So now you're part of, or you have been for a while, part of Gawker proper, where you're actually talking about people with these huge names. And like you just said, you know, you characterize Larry Ellison in a way that I kind of tried to characterize Marissa Mayer, with a slight dig to what she said about working, again, because I'd love to have her on my show and actually talk about how someone works 24/7 is not supposed to have a private life. But, you know, how much of that do you see where you see it infused, where you feel you're writing about things where people have kind of overvalued their self-importance?
Right.
Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, just as two other examples, like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates are doing really good things either with their products or with their personal financial dedications to causes that I think make them go beyond the scope of what they once were, sort of in the way Al Gore did when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, right? He became more than just a former politician, former VP. He became, sort of an icon for the green movement or subsets of it. So I guess, you know, what is your view on the self-importance factor of the various characters that you follow?
You're definitely onto something, that the Valley is this self-important bubble, and it is, and that was part of my wariness and even as much as I love ValleyWag, even though I live in Berkeley, I mean, very much part of the Silicon Valley, and
Berkeley.
I listen to all these podcasts and I read all this technical stuff, but part of my wariness was like, okay, I've been writing about, it's not just celebrities, but I've been writing about a diverse array of industries and people, I mean, at least diverse by within the scope of Gawker, and it was sort of like, well, you know, do I want to get sucked into feeding the self-narcissism of Silicon Valley about itself, which to a certain extent you could argue that ValueWag does. I mean, our mission and what we do well, I think, is piercing a lot of that narcissism, but almost, you know, by focusing on it, there's almost a danger of, well, you know, we're writing a lot about these self-anointed sort of characters, self-anointed sort of gods. Maybe we're feeding into the problem. And so I do see it. I think we do a service of piercing some of it, but I also think there's a danger of, like, you know, helping it feed on itself. And I think, you know, I think part of what, you know, I mean, I think about what you said, and I think a lot of it's true, and I'm trying to sort of frame it from my perspective and what I can do at ValueWag or how it affects me is, you know, one of the things we sort of try to do to get beyond that is to try to look for interesting things that are happening that aren't necessarily part of the Valley. You know, I remember a post we did, and we were by far not the first to write about this at all, but, you know, when something like Spotify comes along out of the UK that's just like this amazing music service, you know, even if other people have written about it, you know, we sort of went out of our way to sort of just like write a fairly positive post. I mean, by Gawker standards, it was a love letter. It was, you know, we have a tag called Things We Actually Like, and we, you know, this whole long thing on Spotify and why we like Spotify. And I think it's incumbent upon us and other sites to sort of try to write things that kind of maybe pierce that bubble a little bit and to look for things outside of the valley that are interesting, that are going on. But also, you know, being willing to say, look, to lend a healthy dash of perspective on things. And I think a lot of what people call snark and a lot of the attitude and voice of ValueWag is sort of dedicated to doing that. So it should ideally be a mix of both. So, you know, and as for the rest, you're right. I mean, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates have both done pretty amazing things that have kind of helped them grow beyond the valley. And, you know, I look at someone like Larry Ellison, and it sort of seems like, not to single him out, but, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of executives like that who are very much still of the valley, like Eric Schmidt, and in all the best and worst ways, like Eric Schmidt, like of the valley very much. Like, not to say that these people don't do philanthropic things, I'm sure they do, but it's very interesting to me, like, how does a CEO make that leap, just on a practical term, to go from a national figure to go from being sort of a very local figure to being a very national leader, whether it's in business or philanthropy or whatever. How do they sort of escape that? And I mean, Jobs obviously is someone who has really escaped the orbit of the valley and the conventional thinking of the valley, and isn't weighed down by a lot of sort of the blind assumptions you see going around. And that's, you know, for the good and the bad of it, it's to his credit, it's really worked well for him professionally at the very least. And as you said, he's expanded that into philanthropy. So kind of a rambling answer, but I don't, you know.
I know, and I set it up with a lot of.
And I think you're absolutely onto something. Like, there is a lot of self-importance in it, and, you know, I mean, if ValueWag feeds into that, it's in the title. You know, we have to. You know, that is our focus, and I'm sure you could say Gawker does the same thing to the elites in New York. But it, you know, it's sort of like a group of people that people are kind of talking about and interested in anyway in the first place. And if you can cover it in a way that helps pierce it a bit, then you're doing some good, I think. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people who read ValueWag do not think of it as a noble enterprise, but I do think there are some, even if they're inadvertent, some positive shakeouts from the kind of writing that we do.
Sure. So I think, you know, if we look, your privacy is an illusion as a hashtag for today.
Right.
Facebook's embarrassing apology, their PR chief issues an embarrassing apology. That's something that hit the New York Times, and I think you actually did a good job of actually adding extra context, right? So this is a real-time example today. Do you want to talk a little bit about that story and kind of the larger theme of what we're talking about, which is
Sure. How
you add to the dialogue, because you actually wrote that story.
Yeah, so that was about a Q&A that the the vice president for communications and public policy at Facebook did with questions curated by the New York Times from NewYorkTimes.com readers. They were a lot of fairly lacerating questions, as you might expect, and they were focused, just to give people context if they don't know, which a lot of people do, but if you don't, I mean, Facebook has been embroiled in quite a bit of controversy. We've hammered on it, other people have hammered on it, about both intentional and unintentional sort of exposure of user information They've kind of changed their privacy policy a couple of times, and there's been some controversy over how they implemented that. You know, we've written that we felt like it was kind of done in a misleading way. And then there have been some accidental breaches where there have been some messages. There were even some private messages that were accidentally leaked to other, like misdirected to the wrong users, like several thousand times. And then there was, you could see people's chats. There was a bug where you could see people's chats. So anyway, the post I did was just about this Q&A where the Facebook vice president really basically apologized and said, you know, we clearly have not communicated well about how we were doing this, and we've not communicated well these privacy changes we've made in a way that was easy for our users to understand and for the public to understand where we were coming from. And I guess my point in the post, sort of my addition to, well, one was just to highlight it, and then what I said beyond that was just, you know, look, his job is, as the VP for communications, is to communicate. So he's basically falling on his sword here and saying, I have not done my job well, which on the one hand is embarrassing, but on the other hand, he's sort of letting his bosses, I thought, off the hook too easily, because it's not just that they didn't communicate it well and not just that this guy didn't do his job, but it's also that there's a real sense that from the very top of the company, from Mark Zuckerberg on down, that Facebook has not communicated well about this from the top, and that they actually, and it's not just a communication issue, there's also the question of, you know, is the service designed well? Should they have made these privacy changes in the first place? And if they did, was the software designed well enough so that people could roll back to the previous privacy settings if they wanted to? I think the New York Times had a great graphic that, you know, there's something like 50 different control panels to control your privacy on Facebook. So that was the post today, and I feel like, you know, there have certainly been other sites like Business Insider and TechCrunch who've done a good job on this issue as well, but like one of the things I feel like we've really been able to do well at Gawker is to be very blunt and skeptical from the beginning whenever Facebook announces a privacy change, and to explain why we think it's going to be a problem, and then when they actually roll it out, being able, because of our voice and because we're able to have opinions, being able to say, look, we think this is really bogus, that they're actually misleading people, and then we go another step and actually publish guides. And again, we're not the only ones to do this, but we publish quite a few guides that get a lot of traffic on how to sort of reinstate your privacy. And Facebook has made so many of these changes that we've probably had like 5 or 6 or 7 posts. In fact, we should probably do a compilation, but we've had like probably 5 or 6 or 7 illustrated posts on how to restore your Facebook privacy, and those always get a huge response, tons of emails mm-hmm. from people. Often they'll prompt really good follow-up questions, like concrete follow-up questions from Facebook users saying, okay, that worked, but then this other thing happened to me, so how do I make sure my privacy is preserved? And that'll kick off another post, and it's just like, you know, it's just amazing the number of people out there who have had these problems and who feel like they haven't been able to get it from Facebook. So I feel like we were able to provide some level of service. And I feel like the more sort of, the less indebted you feel to Facebook and the less you're trying to sort of please them as a company, as a journalist, like I feel like the more you can be on the side of the user. And I think that's something that the Gawker voice is really well suited for. You know, again, not that they were the only ones doing it, but I feel like it really, because of our voice, I think there's a certain amount of trust there that people trust us to be rightly skeptical of them.
Yeah, and I you know, if you look at the homepage of ValleyWag, which you can put in ValleyWag.com which turns into ValleyWag.gawker.com. You can see the, you know, exactly what I'm looking at right now, which is the story that we've just been talking about with the headline, Facebook PR Chief Issues Embarrassing Apology. You know, I think there's also sort of a couple of interesting examples. So one thing I want to tell you before we leave, and again, this is sort of like personal in a way, sure. But in terms of privacy and all of your coverage of Facebook, I'm on the board of Social Media Club and on the Ethics Committee, and one thing that we did a panel on privacy. And, you know, had I known or thought to ring you or get you on Twitter, we might have thought to include you, but we had Ryan Singel and some others from Wired to cover.
Yeah, there's some great people out there doing it. And you got my info. Yeah. I mean, so hit me up in the future. You've got, you know, feel free to
yeah, meet. We're doing a social CRM discussion with Jeremiah Yang moderating on Tuesday. So try to come if you can. But because it's
on Tuesday. And where is that?
It's in San Mateo at Altimeter. So
okay, great.
Our next event will be in San Francisco. We switch back and forth. But I think really there are two other examples that I want to talk about actually from your homepage right now that you've written.
Okay.
That I think are really good examples of what you do. So, I'd just like you to talk about them, because I think riffing about them is really what gives people the most insight to how Valley Wag has gained and still has the esteem that it does in the Valley,
right.
And why people, when they dissent about it, are really longing for the days of where it could cover these things more deeply and some of the
right.
sort of the second layer of influencers. So one is one that I want people to write about, and they never do, and yet here it is. Steve Jobs, healthy but uncomfortably thin. And you actually wrote a story about that. It was posted on the 11th, but it's on the homepage of Valley Wag, and the hashtag is moguls.
Nice. Okay.
But you know, I think that's something that, you know, it's sort of like I think about it, and you know, journalism with a capital J generally wouldn't address it, or if it does get addressed, it gets
right.
addressed in a snarky way. But I think
right.
you actually did a really good job here of writing something that was both informative but tackled an issue that is, you know, like if you're a caring, concerning person and you're going, I really love the iPad and I don't hate Steve Jobs and I don't have any
right.
real – well, I don't like that Apple – or I mean, AT&T is the only one that has Apple's iPhone, but – or iPad, but I bought the Wi-Fi iPad the day it came out and all that kind of stuff, you know?
I've got
I mean,
one. Yeah,
I,
that's a great machine.
I'm looking at a 27-inch iMac screen. You know, I can't complain about my Apple products. So, you know, I guess there's this part of me, and maybe it's like, you know, I'm not a mom, but maybe it's because I don't have kids part that's like, oh, you know, he looks so skinny. Somebody feed him. So, you know, talk to me about the genesis of even creating a story like that. Is it because people are talking about it?
Yeah, no, I don't mind talking about it, and I'll try to be briefer than on the last one. But we have a history of writing about Steve Jobs' health, partly because our sister site Gizmodo wrote some of the early stories, floated some of the early what they were framing at the time as rumors that he wasn't well. You know, rumors that by and large turned out to be correct, and then Valley Wag Owen had a number of stories along those lines as well. So part of it is a continuing theme in our coverage. In this case, we're looking at a Bloomberg story, you know, again highlighting a line that might have gotten lost otherwise in a Bloomberg story about Jobs, you know, that touched on his health, where they had quoted an associate saying he's not well, or he's actually feeling much better. You know, they had a lot of evidence in the story, both from people who knew him and just tangible evidence from Apple's performance that he was healthy. But there was this line, you know, from someone who knew him that, you know, he's still struggling to put on weight. And so, you know, you sort of think, well, how do I come at a story like this? You know, it clearly to me is a relevant story. It's definitely for Valley Wag. I mean, we traffic in stories about CEOs on a personal level, but also just from a financial standpoint for Apple, his health has become an issue. So it's like, how do you approach that? You know, how do you approach that in a way that is not completely inhuman and creepy, but that at the same time, you know, draws attention to it in a way that, because you know people are going to care about it. And, you know, so we just basically in this case framed it as, you know, look, you know, clearly he's well, and we laid out some of our own evidence for why he seems to be very healthy. And one of the intriguing, you know, and I think the way we ended up coming at it is like, look, he's trying to put on weight. This is what the story says, but like, clearly Steve Jobs has this reputation of being just kind of combative in certain contexts. You know, Alan Deutschman's book, The Second Coming of Steve Jobs, and many other accounts about Steve Jobs, you know, kind of paint him as very, very, he can be very confrontational when he wants to achieve the perfection that he's famous for, both with employees and with the press and even individual reporters. And so we sort of said, hey, one of the signs that he's getting better is the fact that he's continuing to be this kind of very confrontational, aggressive CEO. I think it was an earlier story we had done saying, you know, there was an earlier headline we had like on a similar story where we said, you know, Steve Jobs well enough to be a maddening bastard again or something like that. It was about how, you know, his poor iPad staff, like it was some Wall Street Journal story said he had sent them back to the drawing board like 7 times. And it's like, okay, well, clearly Steve Jobs is in good health if he's able to infuriate his poor, or, you know, make his poor staff like go back to the drawing board 7 times. And that's kind of what he does. And it's, you know, whether it's good or bad, I mean, clearly it works for the company. And so I think, so this is kind of how we try to approach this story. It's like, look, the guy the guy, it's not like he's dying, you know, or anything, you know, like that. It's, he's getting better, but let's just, you know, let's just also highlight the fact that he's having trouble putting on weight, and clearly he's a thin guy that, and you know, same kind of thing, like, oh, he's, to a lot of our readers, he's like this person that they look up to, and it's like, oh, he's, you know, poor guy's trying to put on weight, but, and that wasn't necessarily our perspective on it, but there's just a lot of reasons people would care about this, and so we kind of came at it from the angle of, look, you know, this is what the information is. We're not trying to blow it up into too much, but, you know, you should know about it. And he's a fascinating guy to write about.
So,
very touchy, because everything you write about him, you know, of course you'll get the Apple Brigade, and I try not to be conscious of that at all, but also on a human level, you look at someone who's sick, and you know, how do you write about their health? I thought that Bloomberg did a good job of it, and I sort of tried to add our twist on it in a way that was kind of human as well.
And I think, Parti, I think you did a great job. I think, you know, moving, I think you did a great job answering as well, because it's not an easy question to answer. But I also wanted to touch on a couple of other examples. One that, or both of them, actually, that show how ValleyWag brings in this, some could argue, a gawker element, whether they like it or don't, you know. And I don't know if you can reveal or how, you know, how much traffic has changed since ValleyWag, you know, was folded into Gawker more officially.
Well, that's an interesting question. I should know more on that than I do. I know my – let me try to pull up – I try not to look at the monitors. Let me pull up the monitor and see if I can pull up
the
traffic.
But I think while you're doing that, there's two good examples. One is it's hashtag censorship, but it's how Apple is watering down fashion spreads, right?
So this
really interesting intersection of, you know, the iPad edition of Dazed and Confused, the British fashion magazine, and it being called the Iran edition because of restrictions from Apple, generally when you have a magazine that's considered somewhat autonomous, and you're nicely trying to promote a product, you know, you wouldn't seem to get. And then the other that's hashtag Google, which is watch Conan O'Brien's illegal Jay Leno impression that has so many page views and has the on fire mark next to
it
that you guys have that I think are two interesting examples. One, because, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think to include anything from Conan O'Brien versus Jay Leno, but it does relate to Google because it is, you know, it's part of YouTube. And, you know, I think it's
on
YouTube.
Yeah, and he was speaking at Google in that particular case, too.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, it's, again, there is a tie-in that's very clear to why it's part of the Valley, as the blog is dubbed, but also really the intersection of sort of pop culture.
Stalker.
And so in both of those instances, you posted both of those on different days.
That's right.
You want to talk a little bit about, I know you were looking up stats. If you haven't, if you want to talk about that at all, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, we've I'm trying to find the ValleyWag. I know that my page views hover. You can go to. Let's see. Let me find the URL. Like the public. There's an easier URL than the one I have up. I believe it's gawker.com/stats, and then you can navigate from there. Like, a lot of our stats are public, and someone could probably go back and add it up. I know. A great month for me is like 2.5 million page views. A typical month is more like 1.7 million page views. I know Owen at one point when he was the only ValleyWag, he was doing around 2 million. So I think purely in page views, I'm probably about on par with Owen. I would guess I'm under where Owen was. I'm not sure about this. I'm not actually sure. And these are just my posts. This isn't everything on ValleyWag. But
yeah, this is
just curious, and that's what's tricky. I would guess that it's gone up, but I don't have the stats in front of me to prove that. I know that like Gawker is such a large audience that being able to tap that in more frequently to ValleyWag, like since all the ValleyWag posts now run on the front of Gawker with everything else, like
yeah.
I know that worked out really well for Owen on his traffic. It was an immediate boost just for his personal posts.
Well, you're top in terms of new visitors of all the authors across Gawker.
Oh, nice. Oh, good. I haven't checked.
And you're top.
Well, we've gotten
top
that. Conan O'Brien did really well,
and we're
I don't know if this ties in with your audience, but we've tried to be savvier about social media because that's been such a big sea change, I think, for publishers, even for people like Nick Denton, who are very forward-thinking. A lot of them still had to go through an educational process of the power of Twitter and Facebook. And what's interesting about that Conan post is that what put that over the top initially was we have a guy, Matt Charette, who works for Gawker TV and is very plugged into a lot of the social media. And he actually got in touch with the Conan O'Brien's Facebook, what is it? It's like the We Heart Cocoa or like we're Team Cocoa or whatever it is that like loves Conan O'Brien. There's a very large Facebook group of these, you know, Team Coco people, and when they link to it, big initial rush of traffic. Pardon?
I'm pretty Team Coco myself.
Yeah.
So
Team Coco started it, and then I think it got on Dig, and then that post went pretty big, and so and that was a great. I feel like that's a great example of a post that really like does a. It's like a valley. It is a valley post because you know you've got him here at Google talking about like the Google entitlement and joking about it in a very funny way, and the Google arrogance, which is such a theme in the valley. Like, you know, how many people, if you have enough, a couple of beers with them, will eventually, you know, if they know anything about Google, will get around to that topic of, you know, their hiring and their culture. And it's like, here's Conan O'Brien, of all people, talking about it and riffing on it really well. And even to the point where they're joking about, like, the bottled water coming from Costco, which just, like, so illustrates the Google cutback so much better than just me writing a geeky post about, oh, they're using Costco water, like, that would not be very, you know, people would just, I could just see the email, like, oh, my God, I can't believe you're going after Google for having Costco water. But, like, just so when Conan O'Brien does it, it just crystallizes, like, the cutback. So I feel like cases like that really illustrate, A, like, you know, a lot of these valley companies that might have languished in obscurity. Like, I mean, you know, Google obviously has always been a big deal, but even from when they were a Stanford research project. But, like, you know, when you've got Conan O'Brien visiting and actually familiar with what they, on a fairly deep level with the company and what they do, like, I think it just kind of shows like how national their profile's gone. And in that case, it was like, okay, obviously we led with the Jay Leno headline because you can really sell that post to a national audience based on the late night wars. But then you get into the post, and first he's talking about Google and Twitter, and then he's talking about what I really loved is by the end of the clip, not to toot my own horn, but I thought O'Brien was really articulate on the power of new media, both Twitter and sort of YouTube, and the fact that media is changing so much. And by the end of the clip, there's like probably the last minute, I debated whether to put this in, is really just O'Brien like saying, look, this has been like, I thought this was going to be the worst 3.5 months of my life, but it's been the best because I've learned all this stuff about, you know, about how media has changed and about, and I've connected with this really exciting online audience. And it's the kind of thing that could have, you know, that could have sounded really cheesy and been really lame, but the way he put it was just, you know, really powerful, I thought. So I feel like a clip like that really kind of shows the intersection. And obviously it draws traffic, which is nice. But then I feel like, what's the other post you mentioned? The media post
how
about
how Apple is watering down
right, which we didn't bring. I think that was on a smaller blog, but we were one of the first to link to it. And it was like this report. They had a source at a British magazine, that fashion magazine, that was saying like they had to like vastly reduce the amount of skin that was shown. You know, they had kind of not nude shots, but shots of like, you know, there might be a little bit of nipple revealed, or there might be like too much leg revealed. So for the iPad edition, they had to censor all that. And that post, you know, will not do as much traffic, but it really does speak.
It's on fire though, right now on your site.
Oh, is that one on fire? Maybe that one got linked too. Okay, I was gonna say that the O'Brien post helps us do the more obscure posts, but in this case, maybe that's not true.
You actually.
But sometimes
when
you have those monster posts, it kind of gives you freedom on some of the other ones to just write something that you really.
Yeah, it doesn't have nearly the page views, but it's got the little fire mark next to it, so it's at 12,000.
Okay, so that must mean it's getting a lot, like in the last, you know, few hours, which means that, since that one's older, I'm guessing it must have gotten linked somewhere. And I do think that's one of the cool things. Like, it is always, it's fun to like work for a company where the traffic information is just right there, and you know, people kind of think that because we theoretically can get bonuses on the traffic that we're just like these traffic monsters. But really, like, I think we're like the writers at Gawker are like writers at most places where we just want to write sort of things that are interesting to us and that we think would be either exclusive or just really fun. But having that traffic data does really, you know, it can be a small motivator at least to sort of get that. I certainly don't write to get it, but it is kind of cool when it happens. You get that little, you get the flame icon, you see the numbers. It's like a really nice real-time feedback from your audience, or from an audience at least.
Well, we're almost out of time. I've been
trying to post
to Twitter as we've been conversing about different things, and I apologize to the audience if I've been overly verbose.
Me too.
Because we haven't gotten overly verbose. You're the guest. You're supposed to talk. But I mean, one of the, you know, if you want to check out, again, the URL is, because we're on the Blog Talk Radio homepage right now as a featured show. So folks from everywhere might be getting us. So if you're looking for how to blog on a messy divorce or how to use people's incessant self-Googling to get a job, you should check out ValleyWag. Again, you can go to valleywag.com or valleywag.gawker.com. It takes you to the same place. And we've been chatting with Ryan Tate, who is an editor there, who I've known for way too long, and we definitely need a catch-up coffee. So if I know you're
absolutely
in Berkeley, I'm in the East Bay as well. We need to meet in the middle at some point when
it's
good
for you.
Yeah, or
maybe if I make it to one of the social media events that you mentioned.
Yeah, but we need a separate catch-up session anyway.
Okay,
I need to dish with you.
Absolutely.
Dish with you anyway, and then we can really get a sense of you know, how, you know, because I'd love to be able to help you. I've been working with Media Bistro on the social networking component of it and helping audiences understand that as well. So
Cool. Anyway,
whatever we can do to self-help one another, I am so glad you made it onto the show, and I'll let you get on with your day. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much, Jennifer. I appreciate the chance to talk with you and be on your show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ryan.
Cool. Talk to you soon, Jennifer. And
talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
So that was Ryan Tate. He's an editor of the ever-popular ValleyWag. And again, just a fantastic writer in general. And I think someone really to follow. Wouldn't be surprised if he were editor-in-chief before too long of ValleyWag or something else. Really a real talent. But I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. If you like the show, we'd be delighted if you would friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio with a little heart button here. If you're on iTunes, please rate us and give us feedback. We love good, the bad, and the ugly. It only makes the show better. Next week, we have a very interesting guest because he's a little bit different than what you might expect, but he is Mark Smith, who is the chief social scientist at a place called Connected Action Consulting Group. They create real-time maps of where influence and other things are happening on the Internet. So you can actually see movement of, say, Facebook's influence online at any given time. He's done some presentations and workshops and other speaking events at places like Stanford fairly often, and I would love for the rest of the audience to be able to get some insight into what Mark works on. That is 1 week from today, again, noon Pacific. I apologize to those who got late notice on the time change today. But yes, next week we will be at 12 noon Pacific with Mark Smith again. He's a chief social scientist at Connected Action Consulting Group. I don't know why I'm having such trouble saying things today. Anyway, you can always keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and my work teaching at MediaBistro.com at JenniferLindsay.com, and that's S-A-Y. So for all of you out there who've been listening and hung in there to this point, have a fantastic weekend, and I hope you'll tune in next week. Take care.